back? Would you like to move up to the front so that we have a good discussion later on? It creates a much better atmosphere. Good morning and welcome to the symposium on universal access, universal crisis, universal prices. My name is Jaya Sridhar. I'm a medical doctor by training and a journalist by profession, and I've had the privilege of covering the HIV epidemic in India for the last several years. This session holds special significance for India, which is the largest producer of antiretroviral drugs in the world, and we also export more than 50% of our produce to other countries. This became possible thanks to the historical decision by the government of India in 1970 to only respect process patent and not product patents. All this was set to change after India became signatory to the TRIPS agreement, and now we are bound to respect process patents as well. India is particularly at the center of this debate because the dream of whether we realize the dream of achieving universal access or not will depend on whether we win the battle against the restrictions placed on access to second-line drugs. Without any further ado, it's my pleasure now to introduce the distinguished speakers on my panel. We have with us Dr. Kevin De Kock, Director of the WHO Department of HIV and AIDS, who oversees all of WHO's work on HIV and AIDS, particularly focused on initiatives to assist developing countries in scaling up treatment, prevention, care and support, who's going to share his thoughts on scaling up universal access to ART, in particular the challenges vis-a-vis drug pricing and, of particular interest, access to second-line regimens. We also have with us Dr. Mariangela Simão, Director of Brazil's Program Against HIV/AIDS, who's going to share with us the lessons that Brazil has learned in its long battle with drug pricing policies and the challenges they bring. Please join me in welcoming Ellen Tahun, coordinator of the Globalization Project of the Campaign for Access to Essential Medicines of the Médecins Sans Frontières, who is going to unravel the story of why and how patents have taken precedence over access to essential medicines and what to do about it. It's also my pleasure to present to you Dr. Agnes Binawau, the Executive Secretary of Rwanda's National Commission to Fight AIDS. She is a member of the country coordinating mechanism of the Global Fund for AIDS, TB and Malaria, chairs the steering committee of PEPFAR, and is a visiting professor in Harvard. She's also published more than 100 papers on women and children. Agnes is going to share her thoughts on the way integration of HIV in all sectors in Rwanda is being used as a tool to achieve the target of universal access. The last speaker on our panel will be Dr. Richard Elliott, Deputy Director of the Canadian HIV/AIDS Legal Network and the founding member of the Global Treatment Access Group, who's going to highlight Canada's attempt to implement flexibilities in the TRIPS Agreement and share with us whether these attempts were successful and whether the flexibilities in TRIPS indeed allow for access to essential HIV medicines. I'd request each speaker to stick to their allotted time of 10 minutes so that we're going to have at least 30 minutes for discussion afterward. There have been many complaints that there's not much time for discussion after the sessions. And now I call upon Dr. Kevin De Kock.
Jaya, thank you very much. Colleagues, friends, thank you to the organizers for inviting me. Jaya, please stop me if I've gone on for a bit too long, because my text is probably a little bit too long. Actually, if I could start with an anecdote, I have a flashback of 1974. I was a first-year medical student going to an amazing concert by the great blues singer Memphis Slim, and there were just about 20 people in the room, in a room bigger than this, and we were all asked to come to the front. And he had a sort of personal concert from, anyway. You know, if you do want to move to the front, as our moderator said, please do so. All right. In this brief presentation, I'm going to review data on treatment access, interventions for HIV-TB, PMTCT. I'm going to comment on HIV testing. I will make some comments about drug pricing, but I'm going to have to refer to the report that's shown on that slide. This is available from WHO. It's available at this meeting in the media center and from the WHO and UNAIDS stand. It's a very important report. I think this is probably the slide of the conference. You've seen it time and again. 3 million people in low and middle income countries accessing ART, maintained on ART, by the end of 2007, almost three quarters in sub-Saharan Africa, the next greatest number shown in pink in Asia, and in dark blue, Latin America and the Caribbean. But there's with an estimated 9.7 million people considered in need of therapy, global coverage was estimated to 31%. But this issue of coverage actually is more difficult. The denominator is actually more difficult than superficially it seems. These data from 2007 represent an additional 1 million people compared with the year before, with a 54% increase in Africa alone. Access among women is at least as good for men, it's often higher. 97% of recipients of therapy were on recommended first-line regimens, and the prices of these have continued to fall, as indicated from the left to the right in these histograms. The details don't matter. The histograms represent prices for different combinations over time, and you see that for most of these WHO-recommended regimens, prices have fallen substantially. The most widely used regimen, stabudine, D4T, lamivudine, 3TC, and nevirapine, is now available at less than $100 per year, but we heard about the issues of stabudine, particularly in the plenary, and I'll come back to that. By the end of 2007, some 200,000 children were on ART, 80% in Africa. 90% of children living with HIV are in Africa. And this represents an increase by over 60% compared with 2006, and by an increase of about 150% compared with 2005. Now, because of reconsiderations of treatment need and changing guidelines and so on, we're very reluctant to give an estimate of coverage, because we're still trying to figure out what a meaningful denominator actually would be. WHO changed treatment recommendations for infants aged less than 12 months earlier this year, and infants less than 12 months should now receive ART upon demonstration of infection rather than waiting for specific clinical or immunological criteria. But we've obviously got very far to go, recognizing that in 2007 only 8% of HIV-exposed infants were assessed virologically for diagnosis. And since a third of infected children die by the age of 1 year, one half by 2 years, I think a scale-up has probably benefited particularly older children, though we don't have good insight into that, and much remains to be done for the youngest, who face the greatest mortality risk. Concerning tuberculosis, WHO has a 12-point policy defining key health sector HIV-TB collaborative activities. I won't list what they are, but again, the histograms show significant improvement, but still a very long way to go. By 2006, as shown in the light blue histogram, 35% of TB patients in 11 African countries that make up over half the world's HIV-TB burden were tested for HIV. An estimated 78% of TB patients diagnosed as HIV-infected received cotrimoxazole, and 41% of such patients were enrolled into ART, again representing a greater than twofold increase, and these are data from 2006 compared with 2005. But there's certainly a lot to do, and we in the HIV community must focus on what we refer to as the three I's. That's intensified case finding, isoniazid preventive therapy, and tuberculosis infection control. And we need to measure this as well. For the first time, we included PMTCT in this Universal Access Report, good collaboration with UNICEF, with whom we share this responsibility. There are some data on primary prevention of infection in young women and family planning access also. Now, concerning access to interrupt transmission from women to their infants, some 18%, let me skip to the next slide, some 18%, if you just concentrate on the left-hand side of the diagram for the moment, in Africa, the uptake of HIV testing amongst pregnant women was only 18%. It's crept up slowly, as you see. It's actually 18% globally as well. But in some sub-Saharan African countries, especially with the highest burden, it's much, much higher. For example, testing of all pregnant women in Zambia reached 65%. Now, if you look at Africa, under ideal circumstances, this whole map would be colored light. The pink shows the highest coverage rates of PMTCT services, 80%, and then brown, 50 to 80%. Global coverage for antiretroviral prophylaxis amongst pregnant women was estimated at 33%. Just 20 countries, all in Africa with the exception of India, account for 90% of pregnant women with HIV. And 12 of these are in East and Southern Africa. So there's a particular need for this map to look pink in Southern Africa. We're not there yet, although the little pink island above South Africa is Botswana, which truly has shown leadership. Here you see the percentage of HIV-positive pregnant women receiving prophylaxis in the 10 countries with the highest estimated number of pregnant women living with HIV. Coverage in South Africa was 57%, in Kenya 69%, but rates remain low in several very large countries such as Nigeria, Ethiopia, and the DRC. Still, between 2004 and 2007, in East and Southern Africa, the most affected area, coverage increased fourfold. These proportional bars add up to 100%. They show the frequency of different regimens used in 2007. The essential message is that almost 50% of women were still receiving single-dose nevirapine. And an area of great concern is the very low proportion of pregnant women who are receiving combination therapy for their own health, or even to be assessed for it when they need it. There are some important conclusions concerning mother-child transmission prevention scale-up here. We need to do better with linkages between family planning and care services for women. Preventing pregnancy is safer and more effective than using drugs to prevent transmission. We need to do much, much better with women who need ART for their own health, who transmit disproportionately anyway. And it's critical to focus on these women to prolong their own lives, preserve their families, and prevent orphanhood. We're going to be under increasing pressure to review ART regimens for pregnant women with HIV from both research findings as well as advocacy and arguments of practicality. The issue being, should we be using triple therapy for all pregnant women, irrespective of CD4 count, and what to do throughout the breastfeeding period. And this is going to be, we are actually arranging a consultation on this later this year, but it's going to dominate discussion more and more. So your work, our collective work in implementation, has made a huge difference. It's captured in the statistics I just described, but we do have some major challenges for universal access. I've mentioned knowledge of HIV serous status, increased early mortality from late diagnosis, and actually, very worryingly, long-term retention of patients not as good as everywhere as hoped or believed. There's increasing pressure to eliminate stavudine and adopt tenofovir, as well as to initiate treatment at higher CD4 counts. Although we must recognize, actually, in reality, whatever the recommendations, most people are accessing treatment at counts well below 200. And I think Greg Gonsalves very clearly in the plenary discussed some of the constraints around this. I think a huge issue, perhaps one of the most important events in public health in recent time, is the emergence of MDR and XDR tuberculosis in association with HIV infection. And there's a whole discussion about access to those kinds of drugs, the second-line drugs for MDR and XDR tuberculosis. Let me just finish with a quote, which I think is very apt. A quote, and then if you allow some quick highlights on second-line therapy from this report. The quote is we're in an interesting position. How much data do you need to make policy decisions? And the British statistician, the late Bradford Hill, said, quote, "All scientific evidence is incomplete, whether it be observational or experimental. All scientific work is liable to be upset or modified by advancing knowledge. That does not confer upon us the freedom to ignore the knowledge we already have, or to postpone the action that it appears to demand at a given time," end quote. And I think that nicely captures some of the difficult questions we face. To finish with a couple of, from the report, some observations on second-line therapy. In a survey that ended up being of 30 countries, representing about 63% of the 2 million people on therapy at the end of 2006, 97%, the very great majority, were receiving first-line regimens, and were most of them adherent to WHO recommendations. As far as second-line regimens are concerned, only 3% of adults were on these, and they were very diverse. The single most common one included abacavir, didanosine, and ritonavir-boosted lopinavir, accounting for about 15% of patients. So there's many different second-line regimens in use. The data in children are not very different. As far as pricing is concerned, we're not doing well. The median cost of the most commonly used second-line regimen, that's didanosine, abacavir, and ritonavir-boosted lopinavir, was $1,214. Compare that with less than 100 for the first-line regimen. And there are huge differences in price across different countries. For example, South Africa pays $1,600 for this regimen, $1,600 per person per year for that regimen. El Salvador pays almost $3,500. With those comments, let me finish and hand it back to the chair. Thank you for your attention. And you know, a final comment. I think the challenges are enormous, but at the same time, if we look back at what's been achieved, I think we should just, you know, be courageous, keep going, and keep reevaluating. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin, for again holding up that specter, the emerging specter of heavy expenditure in second lines that's looming, and we really need to address it now. I now call upon Dr. Mariangela Simão from Brazil, who's going to talk about the challenges in Brazil to scale up.
Buenos dias a todos e todas. Good morning to all. Although we are in Mexico, I'm going to speak in English because the only language I'm really proficient is Portuguese, and unfortunately, not everybody would understand. Very quick outlook on the epidemiological situation in Brazil. On the left-hand side, you see the country with cities with at least one case from 2009 to 1990 to 1995, and now we have 85% of all cities in Brazil with at least one case of AIDS. Our prevalence is 0.6, but we have, for the past 5 years, around 32 new cases a year in Brazil. We are talking about pricing and access, and I'd like to say that Brazil has a free universal access policy in place since 1996. And I'd like to stress the free universal access, because it's free of extra charge for patients, because everybody pay taxes, and this comes, the budget for the Minister of Health buys all the ARVs in Brazil. So we are really the only buyer. Our budget has been increasing, and for 2008, it's around $640 million. And by December this year, we'll have 190,000 people on ARVs. We do have a national guideline, and patients are treated through the national health system. These are the drugs that are distributed in Brazil. The ones that are in red are locally produced. And we do have two new drugs for multi-failed patients. We introduced T20 in 2005, and this year, we introduced darunavir as an option for multi-failed patients. For 190,000 patients, we have around 3,000 patients that are multi-failed. Okay. I'd like to say we are in Brazil, I think, as close as possible to universal access. According to our data, which is different from the way WHO and UNAIDS calculate coverage, but we are based on our internal data in Brazil, we had like 95% coverage for ARTs, And our price, Kevin, is quite different from what you mentioned. We are a low prevalence country, a concentrated epidemic, so we don't access the prices that are on the access programs for African countries, for example. Our first line and second line regimens are slightly different, our definition slightly different. And I'm sorry I forgot to put abacavir on the first line. No, so it's missing abacavir. We have now in Brazil 25% of all patients are using second line drugs. And these costs, these average costs, exclude darunavir and T20. When you see there's a huge gap in costs on what first line and to second line. And I'd like to say that this is one of the major challenges that Latin America has right now, because Latin America does not access cheaper prices like Africa, and Latin America today has a high coverage of first-line treatment. So what we discuss, we would like to bring for reflection and for discussion later on the debate. The sustainability of free and universal access is related to fair prices. And what is a fair price? That's a good question for us to reflect upon. The first most common price determinant in a country today is intellectual property rights. And theoretically, they're based on innovation, and I'd like to say theoretically, because sometimes you have patents being asked for second use or for drugs that are being in use for a long time. And also, we don't really, by international agreements and regulations, patents are held for 20 years. And how long does it take to really pay for innovation? And who pays for innovation? How do you separate what's the real cost of innovation from all the propaganda marketing that pharmaceutical companies are doing, even on this space, like with bags and nice pen drives and so on? We are all paying for that. So it's really a black box. How do you open that box to discuss what's a fair price? And IP, in theory, promotes innovation, but ends up in monopolies and in no competition at country level. So it hampers access to cheaper and generic drugs. And I'd like to cite here the example of Peru, because Peru now buys lopinavir, ritonavir from a generic company, but at a cheaper price than it was offered by Abbott to Peru. But Abbott in 2006, the total sales of Abbott was around $1 billion. No, total sales, I'm not talking about profit because we don't really know what's profit. A lot of people say that the whole cost of innovation is like $500 million. If in 1 year the total sales are $1 billion, I think we should reflect that. And that's 2006 when the drug has already been in place for some time. Talking about criteria, I'd like to say prevalence and level of income alone or combined are a very poor criteria for Latin America and the Caribbean. And we would like to propose for the pharmaceutical companies some what we call fairer criteria. First of all, an equal cost per patient for all developing countries with small difference according to gross national product per capita. Or consider the level of use of that drug in the country. I'm going to show some examples from Brazil, and the treatment coverage. And the third, and very important, and the costs that are incurred by government from their own budgets. Now, because sustainability and commitment from the a long-term commitment has to come from governments. And if you are paying, you're not paying a fair price, you are not sustainable because you press the health budget for that have to deal with so many other chronic diseases. I'm going to speak very quickly about the case of the compulsory license in Brazil last year, because efavirenz was the most used imported drug, 75,000 patients. This year we have around 85,000 patients using efavirenz. This is the first combination in Brazil is AZT, 3TC, and 32% of patients use efavirenz. And we are paying $1.59 for each tablet. It was stable since 2003. We had a long negotiation with Merck, which didn't result in anything. But Merck proposed to reduce from 1.59 to 1.56. And we asked Merck for the price of that Thailand was paid, which was 67 cents. So Thailand was not paying that. Merck had proposed to Thailand 67 cents. So what I'd like to reflect here, you see that you Merck used prevalence, but didn't use, because it was not convenient, the number of patients. We had a large number of patients and a lower prevalence. And we are buying now from an Indian pre-qualified generic company at 46 cents. Including royalties paid to Merck and air freight. And the estimated savings, I put savings between commas because I don't really like connecting saving money with health, you know, because actually you need to spend more adequately resources, not talk about savings. And from in our contract in 2007, we reduced $30 million in one single year when we bought from the generic company. We're starting the national production by next year. This is just to point out, this is the proportion of expenditure for ARVs in 2006. The red is the imported drugs, and the green one are nationally produced drugs. And I'd like to point out, efavirenz used to be like 12% of our budget for imported drugs, and now it's 4%. Now. And also I'd like to point out, what are the next challenges we have? Atazanavir, the two formulations, 150 and 200 milligrams, today account for 22% of our budget. And tenofovir for around 15%. So, see, what we spend today, we have lopinavir and ritonavir, the other protease inhibitor that competes with atazanavir. We have 43,000 patients using lopinavir, ritonavir. But we have a growing number of patients using atazanavir. And we are paying now almost $55 million a year, which is 22% of our budget. And with atazanavir, the fact that we still don't have a generic pre-qualified, but we are about to have a pre-qualified generic by the end of the year. So it's a process to negotiate prices and so on. The other challenge that we are having right now is tenofovir. You see from the graph, the blue line is the price and the number of patients on the red line. We this year, we started talking to Gilead again. We had an agreement we have an agreement until 2009, March 2009, but there's a rapid increase. It's a first line drug. We already have 33,000 patients using it. And the patent was deposited in Brazil in 1995, but it's not granted yet. And the Minister of Health declared it of public interest last April, so that we could speed up the analysis at our intellectual property office. And what we are asking in Gilead, Brazil is now paying 3.25. We are asking Gilead to pay 1.24, like Thailand. CIPLA is not yet qualified, but it's almost there. Just to finalize, I think we have a challenge, most of us, to expand access to fair prices, review the present criteria for Latin America, to use the flexibilities provided by TRIPS on the Doha Declaration, but to do that, countries have to have support from partners, and I'd like to say that Brazil had two very important partners, the Clinton Foundation and the Medical Médecins Sans Frontières on this process. And now we have a new partner on board, WHO, because at the World Health Assembly this year, it was approved, the Global Strategy on Innovation for Public Health and Intellectual Property, and it's now time to put it in practice. And this is a classic, just to end, I think many of you already saw it, because it's a 2003 cartoon from Brazil, and we always remember that we had a conference that was bridging the gap, and this is filling in the gap. And the money that's there is not dollars anymore, it's euros. So this is very up to date, and it will be, unfortunately, for a long time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mariangelo. I think her session has laid the sound introduction to Ellen's session, which is coming up, which is going to tell us precisely how to get our way around these patents. Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is a real privilege and a pleasure to be here. I work for Médecins Sans Frontières, and we currently treat 140,000 in 27 countries, of which approximately 10,000 children. As many of you know, we have been able to do that because the price of the recommended first-line treatment came tumbling down very rapidly, and we are now able to access first-line fixed-dose combinations for about $87 per patient per year. Without that, it would have been very, very difficult to expand our programs in the way we did. We also have to realize that that was possible because until 2005, India excluded pharmaceutical products from patenting. The scale-up that we have seen in the recent years is really because of the Indian 1970s Patents Act. 80% of our antiretrovirals today are purchased in India, and only a few days ago, the Wall Street Journal, in general, not a great advocate for generic production, had an article with the headline, Generics Fuel AIDS Program. But we have to recognize that the times are changing. And then when we talk about universal access, we also have to ask ourselves the question, universal access to what? The impact of the changed environment with regard to pharmaceutical patenting is quite dramatic. Most people have, of course, now most of the 3 million people that have access, many people do not have access, we have to continue to realize that, have access to a combination that contains D4T, and increased efforts are necessary to replace those treatments with the better and the new recommended treatments. But when we do that, you see dramatic price increases. We should not fool ourselves. AIDS drug prices are on the rise. They are not on the decline. And that is true for first-line treatment, and it is certainly true for second-line treatment. If you here compare the cost of offering second-line treatment to the first-line treatment, the costs are phenomenal, and we are struggling with that in our project. And I imagine that we are not alone in that. Now, there are different responses to that. You see differential pricing, the price discounts by companies, but those are limited. You see that those discounts are not enough. The slides I just showed you, those graphs, are the best case scenarios. I've not shown you the worst case scenarios. That is taking into account all the discounts that are being made available today. Also, differential pricing is not a solution to patent barriers today to the development of new fixed dose combinations, and in particular fixed dose combinations for children, for example. Another strategy is voluntary licensing, and I put the voluntary in quotation marks because the voluntary licenses are often in response to actions by civil societies through legal threats, for example, the successful PAC complaint at the South African Competition Commission, and the very important work that the Lawyers Collective is doing in India with the pre-grant oppositions. We see the compulsory licensing. We just heard from Mariangela how Brazil has successfully used that. We've also heard earlier in the conference about Thailand, and that has had dramatic effects on the number of patients that can benefit from these drugs. We also see developing countries today use government use powers, that is a particular kind of compulsory licensing where the government says, I'm going to make use of that patent for my national program, for example. We also see least developed countries exclude product patents in their procurement practices. These are all very good developments. These are all a result of the 2001 Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health, the WTO adopted, and it is encouraging to see that countries use these powers. We've also seen India in its Patents Act, which they had to amend because of their obligations under World Trade Organization's rules to include pharmaceutical product patenting. But there is some good news there too. India restricts the patentability criteria to real innovations only, and that gives the possibility to have successful, hopefully pre-grant oppositions related to AIDS drugs. And currently there are 15 pre-grant oppositions pending in India. So some of these products that on the one hand we expect to be patented may actually not become patented if those groups are successful. And I should say that is mostly driven by civil society groups, by AIDS treatment groups in India. But when you do prioritize health over patent protection, you come under harsh criticism. I think Mariangela can talk about it. I think also our colleagues in Thailand can talk about it. You're called pirates by the Wall Street Journal. Even the initial responses by the WHO were not exactly encouraging. We've seen retaliation by companies. Abbott, for example, its refusal to make new drugs available in Thailand while Thailand kept the compulsory licenses in place. We've seen legal action by Novartis to try to overturn those pro-health patent laws in India, and we also see a limiting of the scope of the effectiveness of those TRIPS flexibilities that exist in certain countries in patent law through bilateral and regional trade agreements. So we're pretty much down to a situation of hand-to-hand combat. It's sort of drug by drug, country by country. The struggles are becoming much, much harder to bring those prices down. I cannot emphasize enough that we cannot count on drug prices coming down automatically. We cannot sit here and say, and put up a graph and say, look, the prices of first-line treatment, even of the newer drugs, are coming down. They are not. They are much more expensive, and we do not have an automatic mechanism anymore, which we used to have before the WTO rules came into play, that will bring the prices down. We will not have the automatic generic competition. We need to have a more systematic approach to that. If not, we will see patent disputes break out all over the globe, certainly with so many people on treatment today and so many people still waiting to get treatment. So that's the bad news. Now here's the good news, because we also think that that times are perhaps changing again. There is a realization that patent protection for pharmaceuticals has perhaps gone a little bit overboard. I think the Doha Declaration was the first recognition of that. You have to try to answer the question, would these WTO patent rules, this global one-size-fits-all system we have today, would that ever have come into being if at the time that these treaties were negotiated, the AIDS pandemic had existed? I don't think so. So we do have an opportunity to start turning some of that back. We are very encouraged by the recent decisions by the Unitaid Board to establish a patent pool, and they have set a process in motion to make that happen. This decision is based on some of the work that has been done in the WHO Commission on Intellectual Property, Innovation and Public Health, and the recent decision, Marianja also referred to that, the recent agreement reached by the World Health Assembly on public health, intellectual property and innovation refers to patent pools and says we should really examine the feasibility of voluntary patent pools for upstream and downstream technologies to promote access and innovation. And I think it's very good news to see Unitaid move so quickly after that decision. Now, what is a patent pool? A patent pool is a mechanism where, in fact, you put the patent holders put their patent rights in a pool for others to use. Third parties, for example, generic manufacturers or researchers for that matter, can then make use of these patents to produce generic drugs or to do follow-on research. It is kind of one-stop shop. There's no need for a case-by-case negotiations. In a way, with a patent pool, you can mimic a situation as if the patents are not there. So the patents will no longer form a barrier, with one exception, that you will have to pay royalties when you make use of those patents. But we think that that would only be fair. Now, what could a patent pool do? It could, for example, help increase the production. It could help the development, also the production of the new WHO-recommended first-line regimen. We do not have sufficient suppliers for that today to bring the prices down. And you see here the list of rights holders you would have to deal with. I should also say that the patent holders are not always companies. They can also be research institutes or, for example, the US NIH. A patent pool can also help in the development of second-line and pediatric antiretroviral drugs. Here are some examples of what a patent pool could possibly deliver. We would like to see atazanavir, ritonavir, boosted TDF, 3TC, once-a-day second-line. A patent pool could help make that come about. Also, new pediatric formulations. We would like to see research. We should like to see development on atazanavir, ritonavir boosted once a day for small children. That doesn't exist yet today. And of course, for those who would like to develop those products, they do face the patent barriers to that. Now, is the patent pool feasible? I think so. I think there is a political momentum. I already referred to the WHO Global Strategy and Plan of Action. I see a real commitment in Unitaid. There's a commitment amongst the NGOs and the treatment groups. I should particularly mention ACT UP Paris had played a very important role in making this happen. The initial responses by the pharmaceutical companies have been very positive. The International Federation of Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Associations called it very interesting, and believe me, that is a very positive endorsement for that group. GSK already declared that they're willing to put the license patents of products that they are already licensing in the pool. Of course, we would want them to do a little more, but initially that is a very, very good response. European generics called it interesting, and this week we've heard from a number of individual companies very encouraging responses, and Gilead spoke at a session on patent pools that we organized together with Oxfam Knowledge Ecology International earlier this week, which also gave very helpful suggestions of make it come about. Now, are we there? No, far from it. There's a lot of hard work ahead of us, and as is usually the case, the devils, I think we're going to see a lot of little devils, will be in the details of this, of working this out. It will be in the details of the licenses. It will be in the details and in the negotiations on the remuneration. But I hope that we will be able to, at the next conference, talk about the angels and not the devils. So, in conclusion, we have to recognize that we're operating in a changed environment in the post-TRIPS era. We have to stop pretending that is not happening. Newer products will be patented in developing countries, including in key producing developing countries, that without deliberate action will lose their role they're playing today in the provision of affordable generic medicines. Again, prices will not come down automatically. Stop dreaming if you think that will happen. We need to resolve also the IP barriers to the development of the fixed dose combinations. We need the adapted products. We need the deliberate action, but I do feel there is a real momentum to do so. Before I close, I would like to draw your attention to something that is going to happen at 2 o'clock, because to increase access and to improve care and to make sure that we increase the number of people on antiretroviral treatment, but also on good antiretroviral treatment. Yes, we need the drugs and we need the diagnostic tools, but we also need the healthcare workers to make that happen. And I would like to invite you to join the rally at 2 o'clock in support of the healthcare workers. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Ellen. That was an excellent presentation, and it really calls on all of us to push the frontiers of advocacy to help us realize the dream of universal access. And I now like to call upon Dr. Agnes Benavao to make her presentation on how integrating HIV into all sectors is helping Brazil achieve universal access, helping Rwanda achieve universal access.
Good morning, and I thank the organizer to give me the opportunity to share with you the experience of Rwanda. As we talk about healthcare, I want to recall that the primary obstacle preventing access to healthcare is poverty. I would like to share with you what we in Rwanda, in the heart of Africa, we have done over the course of the past decade to roll back barrier to prevention, to care and to treatment. First, we have assessed the situation to take decision on evidence based. In 94, in the post-genocide situation, it was dramatic with a lot of desolation, infrastructure destroyed, poverty, lack of services associated with geographic inequity leading to lack of services to healthcare, with the population having a high rate of illiteracy and fertility leading to demographic problems. We evaluated the first killers named malaria, TB, HIV, digestive and pulmonary disease, also unsafe delivery leading to high mortality for mother and children. And I will share with you where we stand now. The last 4 years, we won 4 years of life expectancy. For the first time, life expectancy went below 15 years old in Rwanda. We are in 53 years for the life expectancy. The proportion of people needed IRT who received the drugs are 70% of all people in need. And I would like to explain to you how we did. You can see also the dropout of malaria, death due to malaria, of two-thirds dropout. First, we create the necessary institution. Secondly, we develop national, we change our national policies, strategies, and plan. And we integrate HIV, AIDS, and the fight against HIV and AIDS in all the sectors, from the policies to the tools used. Done this, we had the vision of poverty reduction measure and promote gender equity. Thirdly, we worked hard to get access to Global Fund, World Bank money, and PEPFAR. With this mobilization of funds, we have several partners, and our strategy is a total national ownership. As you can see, we have several partners, and those are only the major partners in the field of HIV and AIDS and also health. And all partners' funds allocation is decided in committee chaired by a Rwandan official. Either myself as the Executive Secretary of the National AIDS Control Commission, either the Permanent Secretary of the Ministry of Health, for example, for the country coordination mechanism. This strong coordination brings simplified and harmonized planning and reporting tools using standardized formats. All plans have to be approved by the national entities before to be implemented, and all plans have to have the real total and detailed budget. This allows us to understand the real cost and to determine the real cost effectiveness of all intervention, and this is very important when we have to choose what to bring in scale. An example is that all partners, we have what we call a common basket of procurement for antiretroviral drugs, and this allows us with the same money to treat 30% more people. Having 70% of people needed antiretroviral drugs on treatment will not be have been possible without improving the overall health status of the population and without using AIDS money to address development issues that are the root cause of disease, as mentioned before. We have a strategy of no vertical programs, which means an integration of the fight against HIV and AIDS in sectorial programs. And this is an example of the health sector. Giving antiretroviral drugs, before that we need to test for VCT and PMTCT. That means a lab for the test. Before to build or improve an existing laboratory, we need to provide common basic care inside where HIV services will be given. That means basic care for all, not only for people living with HIV AIDS. And this is integrated in the existing health facilities, and this is really a prerequisite for giving antiretroviral drugs in a safe manner and in the respect of the needs of the entire population. HIV money, with that, we have implemented countrywide what we call performance-based financing and provide health insurance for the poor. In fact, HIV and AIDS money has brought an important infusion of resources, using to provide human resource infrastructures, material, drugs, lab equipment, consumable, technical assistance for the overall health functioning from the referral hospital to the primary health facilities and to district hospital. AIDS money have support the central level but also the 30 districts. And here is to show you the increase of the use of the increasing of the health insurance at community level called Mutuel. Now we have more than 75% people paying from their own pocket this insurance, and it saved them for the five major killers I talked about in the beginning of the presentation. This health insurance costs $2, the cost of six traditional beer. That's why for promoting that insurance, we have a billboard with three beer. This is the evolution of the overall, of the use of the overall health care system, curative care. You can see that coming from around 25% of the population use curative care, we are now above 60%. This is the, to show you the increasing of the HIV services, PMTCT, VCT, and IT services. This is to show you the increasing of the people on IT, and today we have 55,000%. We have a prevalence of 3%, and this means 70% of the people in need today. This is to show you our policy of decentralization. This was in 3 years from now, because I cannot put here the 174 sites providing IT. But the only place where there is no site here and here down, this is the national park and this is the national forest. How we did so? We reached that point. To reach that point, we had to improve the financial access to health facilities. We did that through the community insurance. We have to reinforce the community participation in healthcare management and create the demand and increase the quality of care. We did that, all this, largely with HIV money. But we have great constraints, like the majority of the developing countries, it is largely externally financed. We have solved partially that by making the funds country-driven and in-country community-driven with a multi-sectorial approach and a sectorial approach and a multi-sectorial approach. To reach that concept, we need to put the civil society and all sectors on board when we design policy, strategies and plan. And to create sustainable health, we need to come from a low-income country to a middle-income country. And all the sectors are working hard to increase the economic capacity of the country. That means development. That means also that aid has to be totally integrated in our national plan with transparency on both sides, in our side and in donor side. We face other challenges. We have a shortage of human resources. Many interventions are underfunded. For example, the link between hunger and health. And there is still a challenge, even if the costs go down, of the sustainability for life treatment like IT if the global solidarity one day drops down. Another challenge is the fact that development requires long-term development partner commitment for programs, and we don't have that. Thanks to PEPFAR to have signed a bill for 3 years, but 3 years is still low when we want to plan for the future. Having challenge in Rwanda, we have also a lot of opportunities. We have clear political commitment and technical vision. We have strong government leadership and coordination. We have a vision beyond the three ones because we want to integrate all. We have what we call the three ones for the big three. We promote broad-based community and civil society participation, and we have goodwill of partners and global solidarity. We have strong programs on which to build and a vision of full integration. We have also zero tolerance, zero for corruption and lack of transparency. In conclusion, in Rwanda, we want to go for universal access for 2012, but we still have a long way to go. Universal access goes hand by hand with the overall country development and a full integration of the fight against HIV/AIDS in sector. It needs a strong coordination of stakeholders and improvement of the health sectors and the necessary and to be ready to change the law and to create institutions for that. I thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Anis, for that fine presentation. May I now call upon our last speaker, Richard Elliott from Canada, who's going to talk to us about what extent the flexibilities in TRIPS allow for access to essential HIV medicines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm pleased to be invited to speak about the Canadian example of trying to implement the TRIPS flexibilities because I think it's a fairly instructive example and it's one of the few that we have so far of this particular kind of flexibility trying to be used. I'm going to pick up on a few points that were alluded to in Ellen Thun's speech about TRIPS and the flexibilities therein. So very briefly, to put this in a little bit of context, as maybe many people in the room know, TRIPS, the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property Rights at the WTO, globalizes a one particular approach to dealing with intellectual property rules, including when it comes to pharmaceutical products and the processes for developing them. And in particular, there's a couple of provisions of the TRIPS Agreement that are the legal framework within which the Canadian model that I'll be talking about in a moment fit. And the things to note here are highlighted on the screen. The fact that the TRIPS Agreement requires the granting of exclusive patent rights on pharmaceutical products, as in other fields of technology. But also specifically, it does have a number of provisions that provide some flexibility, and the two that I think are most relevant at the moment are Articles 30 and 31. Article 31 is the provision that authorizes certain kinds of compulsory licensing, whether it be to a private actor or for government use. And Article 30, which I'll come back to at the end of my remarks, provides for limited exceptions to the exclusive patent rights that countries that have joined the WTO must grant. Ellen, in her remarks, made reference to, and our colleague from Rwanda made reference to, the Doha Declaration on the TRIPS Agreement of Public Health, the two most salient features of which are to be found in paragraphs 4 and 6. Paragraph 4, I think, is an incredibly important statement of international law, and that is that the TRIPS Agreement can and should be interpreted and implemented in ways that support the efforts of WTO members and their right to protect the public health, and in particular to promote access to medicines for all. In paragraph 6 of that declaration, it was also recognized that some countries, specifically those who have insufficient or no manufacturing capacity in the pharmaceutical sector, will have difficulty in making effective use of compulsory licensing, because if they do not have within their own borders that capacity, then there isn't obviously someone who can be the recipient of a compulsory license that would then be able to use it to manufacture the lower cost generic drugs. There was recognition of that problem. There was no solution agreed at the time in 2001, but there was an agreement to come up with a solution by the end of 2002. They missed the deadline. However, they did agree to a final text, all WTO members, in August of 2003. Now, what is the problem? There is the insufficient manufacturing capacity of some countries to manufacture generics using compulsory licensing domestically. But when you combine that with the fact that there was a provision in TRIPS that limited the use of compulsory licensing by any WTO member to predominantly supplying your own domestic market, then it imposes a restriction on the ability of those countries that do have the manufacturing capacity to issue compulsory licenses within their own borders under their own national law for the purposes of exporting those generic products to the countries that need to import them because they lack their own manufacturing capacity. The drugs are in one place, or the ability to produce the generic drugs are in one place, and the need for them is in another. That was the gap that needed to be bridged. So I mentioned that there was an agreement to come up with a, quote, solution to this problem. In August 2003, and I've highlighted here on the screen in red, the WTO General Council adopted a solution in the form of an interim waiver of this restriction on issuing compulsory licenses for the purpose of exporting lower-cost generics. And that has provided the basis for action by a handful of countries, 6 or 7, to actually implement that at the domestic level. Canada was the first country to implement a detailed legislative framework, although at the very same time Norway adopted a very short regulation that simply replicated the language of the WTO agreement, and I don't think is all that helpful, to be frank. After a long civil society campaign that involved a great deal of effort by a number of people and enjoyed the support of the UN Special Envoy on HIV/AIDS in Africa at the time, Stephen Lewis, and after an exchange of letters between the U.S. and Canada to overcome a similar sort of barrier that the NAFTA agreement might have posed, and through a number of political changes and ups and downs, in a period of 8 months, we managed to get legislation unanimously through both houses of our parliament that would create a mechanism under Canadian law for issuing compulsory licenses for the purpose of exporting generic pharmaceutical products. The legislation was passed in 2004. It came into force a year later, and following a change of government, it has now been relabeled the Canada's Access to Medicines Regime. And I note here on the screen the government's website that provides more detail about the regime. But I'm going to give you some of that detail now, although probably in a little more critical way than the government website does. So how does this particular Access to Medicines Regime, or does it work, or does it? First of all, a WTO member country that wants to import medicines must notify the TRIPS Council, or in the case of a country that does not belong to the WTO, must notify the Canadian government directly, that it wishes to use the WTO mechanism and the Canadian legislation implementing it for the purposes of importing generic medicines. It has to state or already have been determined to be a country that lacks manufacturing capacity. And if there is a patent in place on that particular product that it's interested in its country, then it needs to indicate that it has or will be taking steps to issue a compulsory license. Now, here's where we get to a problem with the Canadian regime, and that is that, frankly, the process is backward. But the process is backward partly because of the way the WTO decision on which it's based is worded or structured. what has to happen is that a generic producer in Canada and a developing country purchaser essentially need to strike a tentative deal and with a determination of a specific drug, a specific quantity that the country anticipates purchasing from that generic manufacturer, with a specific price and a certain time frame. Because it's only when that information is actually already notified to the WTO or to the Government of Canada and provided to the companies that hold the patents on those drugs in Canada in an attempt to negotiate a voluntary license that this process can actually get underway. So the generic manufacturer in these conversations with a potential purchaser is somewhat hamstrung because they don't actually have in hand at that point the legal authorization to supply the product that they're potentially agreeing to supply to the country. So you can imagine from the country's perspective that makes the whole enterprise somewhat less attractive. Assuming there is a product that the generic drug company wants to export and there's a client that wants to purchase it, the product must go through Health Canada's Therapeutic Products Directorate, which is the equivalent of the US FDA, for review. It's the Drug Regulatory Authority. Interestingly, this process is only required for drugs that are exported if they're exported under Canada's access to medicines regime, that is, if they're exported under a compulsory license. That provision was added to the law, even though the law in Canada up to that point had been you can export drugs outside of the Canadian market without going through the approval process. But all of a sudden, when we were talking about compulsory licensing for export, this particular provision was added. Now, to its credit, Health Canada, the regulatory authority, did commit to a fast-track process for any such medicines, and I think that they've been true to their word on that. They have moved things along reasonably quickly as far as drug regulatory authorities go. There was also an issue about how do we do a review, a scientific review of this particular product, if there is no existing comparator product already approved for the Canadian market. Because the review that the Drug Regulatory Authority will be to apply the same standards as if the product were to be destined for the Canadian market for consumption by Canadians, which in principle is as it should be, but as I'll point out later, poses some potential problems, particularly if there isn't already a product approved for sale on the Canadian market against which you can show bioequivalence and therefore get through the review process that much faster. And in particular, that would be the case for a number of fixed-dose combination products because, of course, because of the patents that are held by different companies on individual products, there are relatively few fixed-dose combination products that have been approved for sale in the Canadian market because different companies hold the patents. There's just two or three where it's the same company that holds the patents, such as Combivir, for example. They also have to look at the features that differentiate the product that is going to be exported under a compulsory license from the product, the same brand name product that's going to be sold in the Canadian market. And that's an anti-diversion measure. So assuming that there is this tentative agreement between a generic manufacturer in Canada and a developing country purchaser, the generic manufacturer then needs to go to the patentee in Canada, the company that holds the patent, or companies, especially if we're talking about fixed-dose combination products, and disclose to them that they have a tentative deal with X country for Y quantity of this particular drug, and would they please, would the patent holder please give them a voluntary license on reasonable commercial terms and conditions, which is a requirement of the TRIPS agreement. One of the good things about the Canadian legislation is that it actually limits the amount of time that you have to try to negotiate. And it says you have to try to negotiate for 30 days, and if you don't succeed after, then after that, as a generic manufacturer, you can apply to the Commissioner of Patents for a compulsory license. And another good feature about the Canadian legislation is if the statutory conditions have been satisfied, then the Commissioner of Patents shall issue the compulsory license to the applicant. There's no discretion on the commissioner's part at that point, which is an important feature because it limits the opportunities for litigation to try to slow down the process. One of the other good features about the Canadian regime, and it's really, I think, the best example so far on this point of the handful of countries that have done this, is that it actually has in the regulations that go with the legislation itself a very clear formula for what the royalty payable will be in any given instance. It removes uncertainty, which was, as we heard from the generic industry, a major concern throughout, that they were concerned that if the royalties were left unspecified, then that was going to open the door to all sorts of litigating in the courts, especially in this particularly litigious industry between brand names and generics, that would draw out the process and would constitute additional hassle, additional cost to trying to get through this process, and would really just turn everyone off trying to use it. There is a sliding scale that's set out in the regulations that is based on the importing country's ranking on the Human Development Index as a rough proxy for the level of ability to pay. And there is a maximum 4% cap on any royalty payable, but that's for the country with the highest Human Development Index ranking, which obviously would be a developing country like, or a developed country like Norway, for example, which wouldn't be eligible to import. So most of the time we're talking about countries paying 2.5% or considerably lower as royalties if they were to use this system. If you jump through these hoops and you get a compulsory license as a generic manufacturer, it is a license that is limited to authorizing you to export only that particular quantity of drug that you had disclosed before based on your discussions with the purchasing country, and only for that specific country. It also is subject to a maximum 2-year term, and this was a little invention that the Canadian government dreamed up all on its own. Is not to be found anywhere in any WTO instrument as a requirement, but was thrown in just for good measure. We've said that that should be abolished. And then there are a number of minor administrative sort of details about posting things to websites once you're actually doing shipping and so on. So there are a number of limitations to this regime, which I think help us, that we should understand in order to be able to answer the question of whether or not this attempt to use TRIPS flexibilities works. For one, there's a schedule that's been added to the legislation that limits the products that are subject to compulsory licensing for export. And in order to add to that list, it takes the decision of two ministers and the federal cabinet. So the cabinet plays a role as a gatekeeper for developing countries' access to different medicines using this particular regime. In our view, that should be abolished, and it should simply apply to any pharmaceutical product. If you're a non-least developed country and you do not belong to the WTO, the legislation, again, unnecessarily, creates some additional hurdles for you if you want to be eligible to import drugs, generics made under a compulsory license in Canada, including having to declare a national emergency or similar circumstance. And you also have to make a pledge not to permit, quote, commercial use, a term which is not defined anywhere, and depending on how it's interpreted, and it hasn't been interpreted yet, could actually limit the ability to distribute through private pharmacies, for example. So what's the fundamental problem? The fundamental problem is the process that has it backward, that you need to actually have a tentative deal lined up before you get a compulsory license. What we've suggested is that, in fact, you could resolve this chicken or egg problem by imposing what's called a one-license solution, that instead of requiring separate licenses for each and every drug order for each individual country, you should, in fact, grant one compulsory license up front to the generic manufacturer that would authorize the production for export of that particular drug to any of the developing countries that are covered by the legislation, and it's most of them, with simply the condition that you periodically disclose the contracts that you then negotiate with various purchasers and pay the applicable royalty based on the calculation that's set out already in the legislation. Get rid of things like the arbitrary 2-year time limit. And I just want to finish by pointing to the one success that we've had so far, and it's the only success anywhere in the world of using this particular WTO-agreed flexibility. Last year, Rwanda became the first country to notify the WTO that it was going to attempt to use this mechanism via the Canadian regime. Voluntary license negotiations were unsuccessful, and in the end, a compulsory license was issued last year. And an international tendering process took place. The Canadian generic manufacturer that had developed this one particular fixed-dose combination of AZT, 3TC, and nevirapine was successful in that competitive process, and they've offered a price that is now cheaper for this particular fixed-dose combination than any other price so far publicly reported from any other generic manufacturer. So the cost would now be down to $146 per patient per year. It's expected that that first shipment of delivery, the first delivery, will happen in September or October of this year. And I will stop there.
Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our other speakers who have helped us navigate an incredibly complex area of legal challenges to universal scale-up of ARVs within the very, very short time that we had. We have about 14 to 15 minutes left for questions, so the floor is now open. Our request is that you restrict your question to just one or two and keep them down to about 40 seconds so that there will be enough time for discussion. Please identify yourselves and tell us who you're addressing your question to. Thank you. I think a mic is reaching you, sir. Can you stand up and identify yourself? Yes, please. Can we have the question?
Yes, this is Michael Rabo from Boehringer Ingelheim. It's not a question, it's just some addition to what Richard just said. According to the company policy, we had offered Aspen a non-asset declaration, which means it's a royalty-free declaration, one-sided, going to all WHO pre-qualified companies. They then can produce the product and distribute it in low-income countries, no royalties, and regardless any patent. This is the policy we follow, and that comes also close to what Alan said, in a way, a pooling of patents. Unfortunately, this was rejected, and then Aspen issued a compulsory license, as had been said. Thank you.
Someone make sure that the mics are on.
Hello? Is it on?
Yes, yes.
Just to clarify, I think you meant to refer to Apotex, not to Aspen, in your comment. And we were not privy, obviously, to the details of the negotiations between Apotex and the various patentees in Canada, one of which was Boehringer Ingelheim. The other would have been GlaxoSmithKline. And because this is a fixed-dose combination, they needed to get a voluntary license from all of the patentees that held the relevant patents on the different medicines. But thank you for that clarification.
The question is, are African men good for circumcision?
Yes, sir.
My name is Carlo Nafayette. I come from Haiti. I do have three short questions for the doctor. Coming from Rwanda, I'm delighted to hear this experience, but my question is, how much money does the Rwanda government spend by itself, and if the insurance paid by the population is a symbolic one? Thank you.
We all know that there is no developing country who will fight those three diseases, HIV, TB, malaria, and some others, without the global solidarity. What we try to do in Rwanda is to put all those these external supports in the budget, as a budget support. This will allow us to direct money where we need to direct. Now, in the health system, for now, the Rwanda government didn't reach the commitment like many countries, but I think those commitments should be reviewed because I don't know on which criteria they have said that 40% of the budget should be put in health when we have to build schools, roads, hospitals, etc. We reach now somehow 11%. I cannot tell you what goes directly in HIV or something like that because, as you have seen, we have an integrated approach. And there is no health workers who work for HIV per se. For the health insurance, it is not really symbolic. It is $2 a year for the basic care. Knowing that TB is fully sponsored by the government and partners, as well as antiretroviral drugs and some malaria drugs. Insurance, if you add $1 a year, you get the capacity to be transferred to the referral hospital, and the population pay only 25% of the cost of health, it's not totally free. You give $2 a year per capita in your house by family, so that means this insurance is on individual, even children, not per family, plus $1 to get access to referral for transfer. But for the poor, we have almost 800,000 people who are paid for, partly by the government, partly by a project funded by the Global Fund.
Thank you. We have a question to my left. Please, sir, go ahead.
Thank you. Robert Klitzman from Columbia University. I'm wondering about use of exceptions to the TRIPS agreement for other medications or other tests, even for diseases beyond HIV or TB. Diabetes, for instance, is a problem in many countries. And I'm wondering if there have been attempts to apply a notion of sort of public health importance or urgency to other diseases for which maybe exceptions can be made to patenting.
We should. I think we should. It's, you know, the global solidarity of HIV/AIDS was made by activists all over the world. That's why the world was captured the attention for HIV, and all this happened. HIV is a catalyst for many things. I show you how it is catalyst for development in my country. But it's catalyst for changing the law and the rules. So I think if the world stand up for hypertension, for diabetes, for cancer, why not? But I think we should stand up for that. It will not come by its own.
Go ahead. Ellen, your mic. Yeah. It works.
It works. If I may add to that, legally there are no obstacles to using these flexibilities in any area for any disease or for any product. The WTO rules are absolutely crystal clear about that, and I would invite all of you to sometimes spend a minute reading the Doha Declaration on TRIPS and Public Health, because there is an enormous amount of misinformation about that around, of the nature of you can only use it for AIDS, you can only use it in emergency, you can only use it if the sky is blue or green, whatever. That is not true. It is actually, you can actually apply these mechanisms very widely. What is also interesting is to look at the history of compulsory licensing. European countries and the United States, in the past, when they were faced with increased prices because of patent protection, they have on a routine basis used compulsory licensing and government use measures to import cheaper generics. It's very interesting to study, for example, what happened in the early 60s in the United States. They imported their most of the antibiotics from Europe because they were so much cheaper, despite the fact that those products were patented in the United States. That was common practice, that was part and parcel of government procurement policies. And those are mechanisms that I think we can learn a lot from today in the procurement of medicines in developing countries. And it's really important that we understand the rules. Do not let ourselves be limited by perceived limitations, by barriers that actually do not exist.
We have a question there. We'll have time just for this one question and a question from one of our panelists, and then I'm afraid we'll have to close. Sir?
Hello, my name is Paul Gross from the University of British Columbia, Canada. My question is for Richard Elliott. I wanted to start off by saying thank you as a proud Canadian. I think your work has been outstanding in this field. It's a very important channel for access to global treatment, and I just wanted to thank you on behalf of all Canadians for taking the lead in this field. And as someone who protested in front of GlaxoSmithKline in the fall of 2003. My question is, what is Canada doing to amend these important limitations to the regime?
Nothing. We actually have been discussing with the government or putting proposals to the government for probably almost 2 years now, because we've been pointing out that it actually took 4 years to the month since the law was enacted for it to be used the first time, and it only got used because there was some sustained work by various NGOs and a commitment by Apotex in response to a request that originally came from MSF to develop this one fixed dose combination product. And they did it basically as a gesture of good faith. And fortunately, there was an intervention later on by the Clinton HIV/AIDS initiative vis-a-vis Rwanda that helped get things moving there. That is not a sustainable way to turn on the tap of access to affordable medicines. And the number of disincentives in the regime as it stands now, some of which Canada added unnecessarily and some of which really just reflect the underlying WTO decision from 2003, have been identified time and time again to the Canadian government as problems. Last year, we held an international expert consultation, actually, that included people in charge of doing drug procurement from various developing countries, and we discussed all of the different features of the access to medicines regime in Canada, and the general reaction then and in the months before was people scratching their heads and saying, why would you design a system that is so complex when it's so unnecessary and what you need is something simple and quick? So what we did was we identified a number of reforms, including this fundamental one about changing the process so that you just get one license at the beginning and it covers all countries, and you don't have to renegotiate every single time and all of that. A few months ago, in December, the Government of Canada completed a review of the legislation that was mandated by law when it was originally passed and concluded, and we're here at the 3.5-year mark since the law was passed with nothing yet moving, that it was premature to amend the legislation. Dr. De Kock, in his opening remarks, alluded to the fact that we don't actually have the freedom to ignore the knowledge that we have now in shaping public policy. I think after 3.5 years of the Canadian legislation not being used, and no other country's legislation that is similar being used, we can reasonably come to the conclusion that there's something rotten in the fundamental mechanism and that you need to fix the fundamental mechanism. You need to rethink the August 30th, 2003 WTO decision to put in place a streamlined process like the one that we've described. So far, our government has shown no willingness to do that, but I think they're really off base with Canadians who have consistently said, we want to help here, and this is something concrete that our country can do. So I think they're going to lose some points with the Canadian public for that, and we'll see where we can take it in the months ahead. But more demonstrations will help. Thank you.
We're almost done. We're going to just wind up with a comment from Dr.
I wonder if I could ask the panel, whoever wants to reply. I mean, in this whole discussion, should we be worried about drug development? I think Roche, a few weeks ago, announced that it was actually halting its development and research program for antiretrovirals. And certainly in the HIV vaccine field, you know, one could imagine that quite some different companies would be reconsidering their options. And in the context of the discussion we've just had, what are the implications? I know it's a complicated question, but...
Yes, Kevin, I'm very glad you raised that, because that is often the response we're getting when we say those prices need to come down, and the companies say, then there won't be any research and development. There is no denying that research and development is costly and that it needs to be paid for. The question is, should it exclusively be paid for by charging high prices, and particularly by charging high prices to poor people? If you have a research and development system that is primarily financed through prices, you get two things. Your research and development agenda is driven by where the market opportunities are. And second, that excludes a lot of needs. That wasn't the case. I think we would see also in AIDS a different research and development agenda. And second, you get high prices that leads to exclusion of large numbers of people. Now, we have been proposing, and we're very happy that that concept is included in the WHO Global Strategy and Plan of Action, that we need to move to a situation where you separate paying for the cost of the R&D from the price of the end product. You need to create a market, and you need to create incentives for the research and development, but not exclusively through charging high drug prices, and certainly not through charging high drug prices to poor people.
If I can complement what Helen said from a very concrete experience in Brazil, I think, Kevin, when we issued the compulsory license, I was in Geneva and we talked a little about it. And actually, people living with AIDS are still a big market, you know, for companies, and we are talking about commercial interests. And we are facing a disease that does not have a cure and where vaccine progression is very slow, so we still have a long way to go. And so I think we try companies try to bring a myth, you know, that when you use flexibilities of trips and so on, your Doha declaration, you're going to stop research and so on. And actually the ways to use the flexibilities are very complex, like Helen said. It's very hard to do a compulsory license. We did that, and we suffered a lot of pressure in Brazil. But I'd like to say the concrete example I want to mention is that although we had the compulsory license last year in Brazil of Efavirenz, which was owned by, the patent was Merck Sharp Dohme, we had the registration of Haltegravir this year. So we still have a very big market for Merck. So I don't think that really scared the drug companies from developing new drugs or for searching markets in developing countries where people are sick and need to get treated.
And as it is complex, that's true. Another fact is that that's true that for HIV, the majority of the suffering is in the poor area of the world. So I'm not so optimistic. And I'm a little bit pessimist, especially when my friend a couple of months ago says that there will be no more generalized epidemic except in Africa. And that's why people like me are here, to advocate, to pay attention. They should not stop because the people who are going to use it probably have no money to pay. So we should find another way to compensate research, because that's true also that people who lead pharmaceutical firms do that to get money. So it's a matter of global solidarity, advocacy, and there is something I would like to stand up against. HIV vaccine didn't fail. How many years did take the humanity to do a chickenpox, a smallpox vaccine? More than 40 years, and now this disease, this horrible disease, disappear. How many years it took to develop a polio vaccine? More than 40 years. And here we are only at 33 years of research. So we should also, in the way we advocate, we should also be careful the way we wording the things. There is no HIV, malaria vaccine for now. Nobody talk about the failure of malaria vaccine, and they are still researching. Why this focus on HIV?
Thank you. We've had an excellent discussion over the last 1.5 hours. If there's one single message I am personally taking back from this session to India, it's I understand now the need to really push the frontiers of advocacy. This is an incredibly complex issue that calls not just for simple activism, but informed activism that requires help across the board, particularly from helpful lawyers. And I'd like to place on record here, pay a tribute to the work of the Lawyers Collective in India, which has really pioneered us and got us to prevent evergreening. But it's not going to stop here. We need to keep up our efforts, keep up the advocacy, and work with people like the Lawyers Collective, from lawyers and committed people from all around the world to realize our dream of universal access. Thank you very much for your attention.